Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What are the legal implications of Ebola in the United States? While lawmakers debate whether we should deny visas to people traveling from countries where the virus is epidemic, a handful of airports have already implemented enhanced screening measures to detect illness. Meanwhile, a small number of Americans believed to be exposed to the virus but showing no signs of illness have been placed in quarantine and in some cases have been accused of violating orders not to go out in public. And now a Dallas nurse who cared for patient Thomas Eric Duncan has tested positive for the virus herself, raising new questions about legal liability and public safety. We have three experts here to talk about the story in this context. Attorney Laura Riley O'Hara is a partner at Strasburger & Price, specializing in commercial litigation in the healthcare industry. Nathan Cortez is Associate Dean for Research and Associate Professor of Law at SMU, where his research focuses on healthcare and biotechnology. And Lauren Silverman is KERA's Health Science and Technology Reporter. Welcome, all of you, to Think.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks for being.
Let's start with the question of quarantine. Interesting story. NBC correspondent Nancy Snyderman has apologized for violating her quarantine last week. How are quarantines enforced, and what kinds of options do jurisdictions have for punishing those who violate them?
Well, there are state and federal authorities to quarantine people who are infected or who may be infected with a communicable disease. And both federal and state laws give criminal penalties for violating the terms of a quarantine. In Texas, it's a third-degree felony. Federally, you can be in prison for up to a year or fined $1,000 or both, I believe. So there are criminal penalties. It's unclear whether it's worthwhile for prosecutors to pursue these types of things or whether it's better to keep a more collaborative approach with people who are kind of self-quarantining or trying to comply with the terms of a quarantine.
It would seem the last thing you want to do is take a potentially infectious person and put them in the county lockup.
Right. That'd be a great idea. Let's send someone from quarantine into a prison. If you think hospitals might be ill-equipped to handle quarantines, think of how well a prison or a jail might do.
Of course, quarantines, and I think we all understand why they are necessary, but they're going to end up affecting people who aren't, in fact, infectious, who turn out not to to pose any risk whatsoever. Do they have legal recourse after it is proven that they are not infectious and never have been?
Well, it depends. You know, Texas state law has pretty detailed procedures for getting an order of quarantine, for challenging it, and for the people under quarantine to fulfill the terms of the quarantine and to get out of a quarantine eventually. I didn't see a lot of federal law discussing procedures for enacting a quarantine and enforcing it. Both federal and state law do say that you can use police to enforce quarantines. So there are criminal sanctions. The police can enforce a quarantine. At the federal level, that, you know, would be anyone from the Coast Guard to a whole slew of federal enforcement officials.
Lauren, locally we have people who are in quarantine and we have people who are self-monitoring. What's the difference between those two things?
Well, from my understanding, and it hasn't been made very clear what the terms of the self-monitoring are versus the quarantine, we have still four people who are in quarantine who are related to the Thomas Eric Duncan case, the first patient to come down with Ebola here in Dallas. Those are family, and some of them are family members, or at least his girlfriend. And they have been in quarantine. I believe their time that they could be determined to no longer be infected is up this Saturday. So like you say, the issue of whether or not they are infected, I'm not sure how that's going to play out legally, whether they have any recourse to say, hey, I was never infected. You did this to me. But there's also self-monitoring, and that's happening with many people who had some sort of contact with people who had contact with Duncan. And so on that sort of family tree, as you go down through the connections, self-monitoring is just being done by taking your temperature twice a day. A temperature is sort of a marker, an indicator, one of the symptoms that is related to whether or not you're infected with Ebola. It could be a false alarm, but it's the way they're choosing to track whether or not someone is sick. So it's taking your temperature twice a day. Now, the thing that's interesting is they had several health workers at the hospital who were self-monitoring, I believe 18, and now those people are no longer self-monitoring. They're being monitored by CDC epidemiologists. So that was ramped up another step. Now they're not in quarantine, but they are being monitored. So there's all these different levels of oversight.
So my understanding is that scientists are still trying to understand how this young nurse might have been infected because she was using what is believed to be sort of standard protocols for protecting herself from infection. In terms of her medical bills, does she qualify for something like workers' compensation because she pretty clearly got sick on the job?
Well, typically workers' compensation does compensate providers or any employee who is injured on the job, and it would seem that this situation would lend itself to that easily. But again, this is, of course, something very unusual that we haven't dealt with before, so it'll be interesting to see how those things actually play out.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we're kind of flying blind on a lot of these legal issues because this is our first rodeo. You know, you often hear this is not our first rodeo. This actually is our first rodeo. And we don't have a lot of experience implementing quarantines, enforcing them. I think most people, when they think quarantines in the United States, you think of movies,
right?
Because that's our only experience.
And zombies.
You
think
of, a big plastic tarp goes over an entire city or something, and yeah.
Right. You think of Contagion or Outbreak or any. I mean, we don't really know how this is going to work.
What's very interesting is some issues have been raised that I think people hadn't thought about before. There's the question of property rights. And for example, you know, the neighborhood where Nina Pham has been, I guess, renting an apartment has been sort of swarmed by media trucks who have the right to be out there on the street, but helicopters around. I'm wondering about property values and if there's compensation and if insurance companies are on the line for losses that are associated with decontamination and maybe with the fact that those spots might be tough to rent out later on?
I'm certainly not an insurance expert, but I don't think I have ever seen any policy that would cover that kind of issue. And, you know, you typically see in your insurance, your homeowner's insurance, for instance, exclusions for acts of God and various other things that are essentially not controllable. So, again, we haven't dealt with this before, so it remains to be seen how all that will pan out. But I suspect it will be like many other acts of nature that people sustain damage as a result of but that they aren't compensated for.
Yeah, Texas state law actually has some provisions that govern who pays for medical care required during a quarantine. And often they require someone who's insured to use their insurance. And they often talk about Texas state law also talks about who has to pay for any remedial measures or cleanup to private property. And it puts the onus on property owners themselves. But it doesn't speak to the insurance issue kind of things down the chain of causation that might cause property values to decrease or, you know, incidental property loss. It's all focused on the person responsible for doing cleanup.
Excuse me. On the neighborhood level, it really doesn't seem like there's so much fear that people – I didn't get the sense when I was out in the community in the M Streets neighborhood in Dallas talking to people on Sunday and on Monday. It didn't seem like there was much fuss or legal threats that the neighbors were talking about at this point, at least. Things are somewhat calm. The helicopters aren't there anymore from what I know, at least the most recent that I've heard. And most of these people who live in this part of the neighborhood are pretty well educated and understand that the threat to their safety isn't a big concern. So it doesn't seem like they're threatening lawsuits so far.
Not least because she wasn't hasn't been critically ill, to my knowledge, thus far, and wasn't at a particularly infectious stage as far as what epidemiologists have said about the way the disease is transmitted. When she was home, the moment she felt bad, she went to the hospital.
It's very different than the first case where Thomas Eric Duncan arrived at the hospital with a fever and was sent back for 4 days in the Vickery Meadow apartment complex in Dallas, where he was highly contagious and reported to have been vomiting and having other bodily fluids that are highly infectious for several days. In this case, from what we know, there's only been one person that the nurse had contact with who is in isolation currently. So the risk seems much lower.
And this person is not ill as far as we know, but it has been placed in medical isolation.
Yes, it's proactive isolation is how the Dallas mayor, Mike Rawlings, referred to it. And there's been no symptoms so far.
How is the nurse doing?
From what we know, stable. She sent out a few quotes this morning through Texas Health Presbyterian saying that thank you for the prayers and so on. So she seems to be at least in good spirits, and they say she's in stable condition.
Mm-hmm. I want to talk about privacy because the first reports that I read when she self-admitted herself to the hospital said that she had requested complete privacy for herself and for whoever this companion was that was with her when she went to the hospital. Now, her name is public. We know where she went to high school. We know where she goes to church. And it seems, you know, like she's a very much loved person. But clearly her privacy is no longer something that if she has a right to it, it's certainly not something that she is able to keep private. Are there laws that should have been in place to keep her identity from being made public?
Well, there most definitely are laws in place. The HIPAA Privacy Act, most notable, and of course, if you'll notice, the hospital has not published any information about her, and by law, it would be prohibited from doing so because she's a patient. But unfortunately, because of the era we live in, with everybody being able to just Google an address and come up with the person who lives there, it's a very easy jump for folks in the media, for instance, or otherwise to drive by, understand, look and see where the yellow tape is, and it's pretty easy to figure out who's living there, and it's very unfortunate for her if she wanted privacy that she no longer has that, and she now has the entire world really watching her, and in some respects maybe that's good. She's getting a lot of support, and people obviously really love her and think very highly of her, and that's a great thing. But if she didn't want her identity to be known, it's very unfortunate that happened.
So HIPAA only applies to medical providers. So my doctor can't tell you I'm allergic to cats, but Lauren can tell you I'm allergic to cats and the story's out. Is that?
Well, it's a little broader than that. It it applies to anybody who has access in the course of relationships with providers and have therefore a duty to protect the patient's confidentiality. But when you start getting out into the realm we just discussed, that's where the privacy laws don't reach that far.
Yeah, and I saw in the Mr. Duncan's case that his girlfriend had confirmed that he was indeed infected with Ebola, patient zero, or whatever you want to call him. In this case, I saw some media reports that were referencing her actual medical record. And to me, it's one thing, like you said, for a spouse or a loved one to say, yes, my husband, my wife, my child is the person infected. It's another thing to have the medical record floating around, and that would be a violation of federal privacy laws and HIPAA, and their Texas state privacy laws as well.
I think on that point, though, and again, I don't have any direct knowledge of the situation, but what I read indicated that the family of Thomas Eric Duncan actually released the medical record to the AP.
I'm just going to clarify. I don't think that we've seen any medical records from Nina Pham. We've seen medical records from Thomas Eric Duncan, about 1,400 pages of which were released to the AP by a family member.
We'll talk in a minute about what that suggests about the plans that the family may have to pursue legal action in just a minute. With my guests, we have KERA Health Science and Technology reporter Lauren Silverman here, along with Nathan Cortez, who is Associate Dean for Research and Associate Professor of Law at SMU, and Laura Riley O'Hara, a partner at Strasburger & Price, specializing in commercial litigation in the healthcare industry. You can join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372. Back in 2 minutes.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education with courses in art, culture, history, communication, photography, and film studies. Registration online at smu.edu/think.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour about the legal implications of the cases of Ebola that have been reported in Dallas. We're speaking this hour with three guests, expert panelists. We have Laura Riley O'Hara, who is a partner at Strasburger and Price. We have Nathan Cortez, Associate Dean for Research and Associate Professor of Law at SMU, and Lauren Silverman, KERA's Health Science and Technology Reporter. If you'd like to be part of the conversation, you can call us at 1-800-933-5372, or you can email think@kera.org, or send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think. Just a little more on the question of HIPAA. Is there a provision in the law to reflect the fact that certain individual private health concerns are also public health concerns? And therefore, are the individual rights of a patient to privacy, do they trump the rights of, say, a community to be informed about the presence of an infectious disease in their their vicinity?
You know, federal and state law has both have provisions that talk about exceptions to the requirement that these records be kept confidential. In Texas state law, there are exceptions for law enforcement, for public health officials to receive records and to know what is happening. So that makes sense. You want federal and state health authorities to have access to public records. You read these statutes, you don't see any exceptions for newsworthiness or for someone who whose medical information you want because you live down the street or, you know, your child goes to school near that person. Federal law, you know, is roughly the same. You have exceptions for legitimate law enforcement purposes, for public health purposes. So the officials and the caregivers who need this information can access it as necessary, but you don't have these broad exceptions for newsworthiness.
Lauren, you mentioned before the break that the loved ones in this country of Thomas Eric Duncan appear to be behind the release of documents related directly to his case. Detailed information about what went on in the hospital and different records and different times. Have you heard that there is any intention on the part of the family to bring legal action in this case?
I haven't heard whether or not they have that they have that intention, but it seems from the release of such records that may be down the road. I mean, the AP reporters who received the 1,400 pages of medical records of Thomas Eric Duncan's have a wealth of information, and they've already highlighted some inconsistencies with what Texas Health Presbyterian was originally reporting and the care that Duncan and his status as he was a patient. For example, when he first went in, it was reported that his temperature was, I believe, 101. They saw in the medical records that it was 103 with an exclamation mark, which may denote – this is what the reporter from the AP who got these records told me – from their understanding, denote some sort of important highlighting component in an electronic medical record to draw attention to that. So there are things that seem ripe for legal action, but I don't know what their intentions may be.
What do you think, Laura?
Well, I think that's a broad question, and we tend in our country to be extremely litigious, and people tend to think first and foremost, is there going to be a lawsuit? And I think the reality of this is when you look at what is required under Texas law for a plaintiff to prevail in a medical malpractice lawsuit, it's a very difficult hurdle. And I think the other thing we have to think about is the fact that hospitals and healthcare providers have been thrown into this head first. He was literally the first case of Ebola to be diagnosed here on this continent. the entire continent. And in a medical malpractice case, the inquiry turns on whether the care provided was within the standard of care that's considered acceptable for a reasonable provider under the same or similar circumstances. Well, when you're looking at a disease that has never been diagnosed on this continent, who's to say what the reasonable care, you know, is in that context? I mean, the symptoms he came up with were, when you think about it, very general: fever, abdominal pain. There are probably scores of illnesses that people can have with those symptoms. And it's very unfortunate that, and I suppose understandable, you know, given the seriousness of the disease, that people are so concerned. But if you step back and you look at whether it was reasonable for those providers to have done what they did, to me, the answer is they did the best that they could. And the standard for providing emergency room care that a plaintiff has to meet in order to prevail is a very high one. It's not your typical negligence standard that you would see if somebody was being treated in a doctor's office or by a provider that was familiar with their condition. It's a higher level. It's a basically willful and wantonness. So in other words, for a plaintiff to prevail in a lawsuit against an emergency room provider, that's the standard of care that they would have to meet. And so that's, you know, that's a very high standard. And I've been representing doctors and hospitals for over two decades now, and I've never met a willful or wanton healthcare provider. They almost to a number have their healthcare providers because they want to help people. They want to do the right thing. And just because this wasn't identified the first time he came in doesn't mean that the providers who attended to him weren't trying to do the right thing.
In a right-to-work state like Texas, can healthcare workers refuse to come to work because they're afraid for their safety? Without, in other words, could they take a sick day because they're concerned about their own safety? And you know, I'm wondering whether there is any ability to force healthcare workers to go back to work.
You know, I think this might be another instance of us just being in uncharted territory. I mean, we just don't know. You know, the analogs are people being conscientious objectors. I don't want to perform a certain abortive procedure, for example, because I'm against it. I don't want to prescribe certain abortive drugs because I'm against it. In this case, you know, if you're I think another analog are the HIV AIDS cases from the 1980s of physicians and dentists refusing to treat people who are HIV positive because of their status. And, you know, there's case law saying that, you know, addressing whether this is covered by the Americans with Disabilities Act. My hunch, and I'm not an expert on the ADA, but my hunch is that the ADA might cover someone with Ebola who's got a major life impairment and who's critically ill. And so refusing to see someone in the ER, refusing to treat them might in fact be a violation of the ADA. You know, I defer to employment law experts on this and disability law experts, but
we can only fit so many lawyers in the studio.
Yeah, you guys would be overrun with lawyers.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. You can also email us at think@kera.org. We have an email from KC in Dallas who asks, once a governmental entity issues a quarantine order, does it have any obligation to provide shut-in people with food, toiletries, utilities, and other necessities during the quarantine period? My understanding is that these things have been provided for those in quarantine, but
and more. Mm-hmm. They provided one of the young men who's in quarantine in an undisclosed location in Dallas who had contact with Thomas Eric Duncan with a basketball and I believe a football. So I don't think that was required, but that was a gesture of kindness, mm-hmm. you could say, on behalf of the city.
And I think that it, you know, it just stands to reason that, I mean, part of the balance is you're trying to protect the greater public by doing these quarantines and isolations. And so you have to make sure that the person who's been isolated or quarantined has access to what they need. It just would be, you know, inhumane to not do that. But again, we haven't dealt with quarantine on this level before, probably since we had, you know, the 1950s, there were quarantines for polio. In the 1920s, there were quarantines for typhoid fever. I mean, there have been various points in our history, probably times when we weren't as evolved as we are now. But I think it would, I can't imagine our city and state officials not making sure that the folks who have been quarantined have what they need in terms of comfort measures and food and whatnot.
And I saw, to your point, Nathan, earlier that I believe some funds or some money compensation would be provided to the people who were in quarantine under the ADA.
Yeah, that might be the case too. And Texas state law has provisions talking about who's responsible for medical care and who's responsible for cleanup. It doesn't say anything about who's responsible for food and entertainment. Mm. So, but again, if we want people to stay in quarantine, yeah, it might be a good idea to help them.
And not be afraid of quarantine. I mean, it's a pretty scary word from just in my opinion. So if someone says if you have symptoms, it's probably to the city, state, country's benefit to have less fear around that word so that people are more likely to admit that they have a fever and that they have other symptoms that are related to Ebola.
By all accounts, Thomas Eric Duncan traveled to this country and showed no signs of illness. There have been reports that he was not entirely honest on migration forms that he filled out from Liberia before he left home about whether he'd had contact with a patient who had Ebola. There's been talk of, before he died, unfortunately, there was talk of prosecuting him both here in Texas and also in Liberia. On what grounds, I suppose, is it lying on official forms? What would be the grounds for prosecuting someone for something like this?
Yeah, there are both federal and state provisions that speak to this. In Texas, it's a misdemeanor to knowingly or intentionally come to the state with a communicable disease without first notifying the state. So that's pretty clear. Federal law, you can't make a statement on a federal form without violating that's not truthful without violating some provision in the United States Code. So I'd be shocked if it wasn't also a criminal penalty under the U.S. statutes to lie on a form in which you were entering the country, you know, a customs form, for example. The question, of course, is a factual one. Was he lying? Did he know that he was at high risk? Did he know that he was possibly or probably infected? Again, we don't have a whole lot of case law, judicial opinions that can guide us.
Lauren, during the SARS epidemic, there were something like 36 million people screened and a huge, much smaller number of them actually had a fever. No one who was stopped at airports turned out to have SARS. People had the disease in other places. What's the feeling among the people that you've spoken to about travel restrictions and whether they make sense and what makes sense?
I think it's a very mixed bag. It depends on who you talk to and whether they support or don't support travel restrictions. But overall, the feeling is that travel restrictions would be ineffective and actually hurt both Texas, Dallas, the U.S. in the long run, because what ends up happening is the countries that are most affected in West Africa end up having bad economic outcomes from restrictions, travel restrictions, and the disease there could actually get worse, as in addition to healthcare workers not being able to travel there to help in the outbreak. So it could actually, in the long run, be bad for the spread of Ebola. And there hasn't been – it doesn't seem like it's going to go in the direction, in the U.S. at least, of banning flights going that far.
There has already been concern from within affected countries in West Africa that some commercial carriers are just deciding not to to suspend their routes into those countries. And there have been problems with healthcare workers who want to help being unable to access patients that might need them.
That might need care there. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And also it's an issue in terms of getting supplies. You have to think about the things that are needed, that are necessary to treat people with Ebola. I mean, basic supplies that are here we take for granted. Surgical masks, gloves, even you know, out the clothes that you wear to protect yourself from being contaminated. Those are things that need to be shipped and need to be shipped in massive amounts to West Africa. And travel restrictions would also impact the ability to get that type of those type of medical supplies over there.
So Ebola was first identified in 1976, but many researchers have said you can only fully study it when an outbreak is ongoing, and no one ever really knows when these are going to happen. So there is still a lot that is that scientists are still trying to understand. But in terms of experimental therapies, these blood transfusions, there's this a couple of medications that have been used. There are interesting questions right now about informed consent and whether you can get informed consent from someone who is well aware that they have a disease that could kill them. What kinds of considerations do you think are ongoing with regard to protecting patients' rights while also possibly giving them an opportunity to benefit from what might work but is still experimental?
Yeah, so on the federal level, once we declare a public health emergency, it triggers all of these extraordinary – well, not extraordinary. It triggers all of these extra legal powers and exemptions. And one of those is an exemption for the FDA to grant experimental treatments the clearance to be used without going through all the normal protocols. So – the plasma transfusion that Mrs. Pham is getting might qualify for that. Like you said, though, I think it's important for the people providing these experimental treatments to tell the people receiving them that they are experimental and explain the basis for them working well and the possibility that they won't work. But there are public health authorities and federal laws that will trigger in cases like this that will allow researchers and scientists to take an unverified diagnostic test or a therapy and put it to use and to see if it works.
What's also interesting, and I know this is right up your alley, Nathan, since you do a lot of work with the FDA looking at regulations, is I've seen several warning letters, three so far, sent to companies claiming to have treatments for Ebola or prevention or cures. And I'm going to be working on a story on that this week. That are false.
So claims. Scams is
scams.
What you're saying.
Yep. For Ebola treatment, those are out there.
Unfortunately, this sort of thing always happens when people are frightened enough by something. We're speaking this hour with KERA health science and technology reporter Lauren Silverman, Laura Riley O'Hara, a partner at Strasburger and Price, and Nathan Cortez, associate dean for research and associate professor of law at SMU. We'll come back to our conversation about the legal implications of Ebola in the United States in just a minute. You can join us by calling 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education with courses in art, culture, history, communication, photography, and film studies. Registration online at smu.edu/think.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour about the legal implications of the presence of Ebola in the United States and specifically in North Texas. With us, we have Nathan Cortez, Associate Dean for Research and Associate Professor of Law at SMU. His research specializes in healthcare and biotechnology. Laura O'Hara is here as well. Laura Riley O'Hara, she is a partner at Strasburger and Price and specializes in healthcare litigation. And we have our own Lauren Silverman, KERA's health science and technology reporter. If you'd like to join us, you can call 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. What obligations do public health authorities have to inform the public about what's going on and to take reasonable measures to protect people? For example, there were people who had spent time with Thomas Eric Duncan and they were students in public schools. What kinds of responsibility does the state have to keep those individuals out of contact with other people?
You know, what's interesting looking at federal and state law is how frequently the statutes use the words reasonable and appropriate and necessary. And my takeaway from that is that the statutes are really trying to give public health authorities a lot of discretion to do as they see fit. So to the extent necessary, the state can quarantine and decide the parameters of that quarantine. To the extent appropriate, the CDC can take certain actions. So what's happening here is legislators are giving public health experts a lot of leeway to tailor their response to the local circumstances. And so it really is up to the discretion, and a lot of the standards are, you know, up to the CDC and the Texas state authorities.
Lauren, what do you know about the kinds of investigations that take place, that will take place at the hospital to try and figure out the source, what caused Nina Pham to become infected?
Well, right now they're just starting with interviews. After that, I'm not sure how they're going to look through all of the different processes. They have some ways to do this, but they're starting with interviews. First of all, they just need to make sure they have all the contacts that Nina Pham was in contact with, and then all the people who treated Thomas Eric Duncan. But then they go through procedures and ask about procedures and make sure that everything was followed. They've said that the procedures were followed, the CDC recommendations in terms of how you suit up, how you treat a patient. Some of the treatments that they were giving to Thomas Eric Duncan were treatments that have never really been done before on an Ebola patient, or at least haven't been reported, such as dialysis or intubation. These are medical treatments that are put a healthcare worker at very high risk of coming into contact with the bodily fluids of someone infected with Ebola. So even if they were following procedure, it's possible that just the high risk of these actions,
the invasive nature
of the treatment, makes it perhaps more likely that there's the spread of Ebola. Then again, there could have been some other unrelated breach that we don't know about that someone may not even remember. So it's going to be hard to track down, from what I can tell, the exact moment or what caused the infection. I don't know if they'll be able to do that.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. You can also send email to think@kera.org. We have a question here. Can someone refuse the temperature test at the airport? Can someone refuse a health screening?
Well, I'm not an expert on those issues either, but my assumption would be it would fall into the same category of refusing to go through the metal detector or refusing to take off your shoes or do any of the other, you know, many things that we have to do just as part of, you know, what it takes to fly these days. So I suspect that would not be met with you know, favorable response from those in charge at the airport of taking those measures.
Yeah, there's some, you know, the CDC has about 20 quarantine stations at the busiest ports of call around the country. And I think if you refused something like that, you might find yourself becoming familiar with one. But there are really interesting legal issues on how far the government's power stretches, and there are constitutional issues. You know, how long can I be quarantined? Can I file a writ of habeas corpus to get out of quarantine? And again, I go back to the same point that there's a lot of discretion for public health officials. There's a lot of discretion for the CDC, Homeland Security, and the TSA would be the ones administering these procedures at airports and the like. And you know, we just haven't probed the outer boundaries of the government's ability to enforce these things. But the statutes are very clear that the government does have a lot of discretion to do what's necessary to prevent a plane load of patients carrying Ebola or even a single individual from coming to the United States and refusing to play ball, to go through the protocols and to submit to these tests.
And the statutes, as Nathan said, are broadly worded, but the application, you know, the way we've seen these things, not obviously in the case of Ebola, but similar things, the more lethal the threat, the higher the level of power the government officials have to try to contain it. Because, again, it has to be a balancing test. You balance the liberties of a few to, you know, over the good of the many. And that's just something that we're all going to have to feel our way through as this unfolds.
And certainly we want to screen out sick people, if for no other reason than to make sure that they get the care that they need, if in fact they are critically ill. There are questions about whether it could be, you know, the word of someone doing the screening versus the word of someone else. Could this be applied in a way that is abusive or somehow discriminatory? I wonder how much any of you is hearing discussions about that possibility.
Yeah, that's the risk, right? So if you're an African, a black African coming to the United States from Africa, you're probably more likely to be screened than a white African coming from South Africa, for example.
To be fair, there is no Ebola in South Africa,
right?
Among
right.
The white or black population.
You know, if you're a white African coming from West Africa, mm-hmm. You might not be screened. Or if you're a caregiver, mm-hmm. You know, if you're a non-black caregiver, a physician returning from your trip, you might slide through more easily. So there are questions about, you know, the discretion people use to enforce these things.
And I do think it is a high burden to put on an airport screener to be in the position of trying to figure out whether somebody potentially has Ebola based on fever. I mean, again, fever can mean a million different things. And so is that really the best way for us to be evaluating this? And because it's the first time, nobody has the answer to that question. It's just going to take time and seeing how this unfolds before we really know what the right answer is. But, you know, I think it is interesting, Lauren, you referenced earlier the issue of the embargoes, the flight restrictions, and, you know, maybe it needs to be something, you know, split down the middle, not a complete ban, but a ban on non-essential travel. You know, if mm-hmm. people are just coming here for vacation, maybe that's really not the best time to be doing that. If you limit the number of people, you limit the people to those who have to come for a documented reason or the shipping of supplies, as opposed to just business as usual, and then expecting these screeners at the airport to be the ones to keep any potential, any people who may have the virus from entering. Because once you're here, then that person is in a terrible situation. They're not in their homeland. They're not with their friends and family. I mean, unless they are coming, unless they are U.S. citizens. And so it's a real quandary.
Lauren, are you hearing about discrimination against members of the Liberian American or Sierra Leonean American or Ghanaian American population locally?
Well, I haven't actually been much in the community reporting on that, but we have had reporters at KERA going out to some of the churches and some of the places that are filled with people from Liberia or whose parents are from Liberia or other countries, and they've said that they are worried about discrimination, and that's a concern because it became when Thomas Eric Duncan came here, it did become an issue of here is someone from West Africa with this disease bringing it to the United States. And there seemed to be a lot of concern among the Vickery Meadow apartment building complex, the Ivy Apartments, I believe it's called. And there were reports from about discrimination. We weren't able to confirm any of them, but people being turned down for employment or people being turned away at restaurants because of appearing to be from West Africa and maybe from that apartment complex. So there are definitely concerns. I don't think any of them have been proven legally at this point, but it's a worry.
Let's go to the phones now. 1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak with Alex in Plano. Hi, Alex.
Hello.
Hi, go right ahead, please.
Yes. My name is Alex. I'm from Central African Republic, and I've been living in this country for 21 years, and I have not been out of U.S. due to my situation. I am a nurse. And I have a question for your panel, and it's more about international laws. We do know that there are a lot of scientists that work all over Africa. Are there any international law that guide those scientists all over Africa, just in case if some of the work that they are doing, even for good cause, may go wrong, for instance, in the case of some of those laboratories, because there are not some guidelines such as they are here in the United States?
So I guess a question about whether there's liability for people who are traveling through regions that could put them in contact with people who are ill. I hope that I'm summarizing that appropriately, Alex, or maybe we can talk a little bit about what you know about international law in cases of communicable disease.
Yeah, so, you know, when we talk about international law and pandemics, epidemics, communicable diseases, we're talking mostly about the WHO. And the WHO doesn't have a lot of coercive powers. It doesn't really regulate in a traditional sense. It mainly exists to coordinate national responses to epidemics and problems and disseminate information and serve as an information clearinghouse. So the WHO does tremendous work, and you know, its officials are on the ground in these affected areas, and it is really active. It's not in the business of implementing international law all over Africa and the United States, and kind of it's not the supranational governing body. It's more of a standard setting, educational information disseminating institution. So it's, you know, it's mostly up to the local governments, to the national governments, to regulate this kind of thing.
Let's go quickly back to the phones here. We have Retha on the line in Carrollton. Hi, Retha.
Hello. Yes, I'm calling just to give a big vote of confidence for Presbyterian Hospital in Dallas. I'm a registered nurse, a master's prepared nurse, and I worked there for 8 years in the medical intensive care, where I'm assuming most likely patients with an Ebola, maybe I cared for, especially those in the ICU. That was where I worked. All of the nurses there, I could say maybe one or two I ever met, are very professional. They take it as a calling that they're nurses, and they take all the precautions that you could ever take against transmitting it to themselves, their family, other patients in particular. The doctors are just top flight. Dr. Goodman is world-renowned. He's the head of infectious disease there, and all of his colleagues are very well-respected.
Well, Retha, thank you so much for your call. And Lauren, does that coordinate with what you've been hearing about the standard of care that would be expected to be available at a hospital like Texas Health Presbyterian?
Yes. I mean, I haven't heard complaints of or anything that suggests that someone hasn't been cared for on purpose. I haven't heard anything about that. I think the concerns have more been with what the hospital knew when it knew it and the way in which some of the information was relayed to the public about that, whether it happened in a timely manner and whether it was all accurate as well. And I think that goes with what the other experts here have been saying about this is the first time that we've had a person diagnosed with Ebola here. And so it's difficult, I imagine, for the hospital to know exactly what to do. I certainly understand that. And it's been a relentless for them to try and stay on top of getting all the information out.
Lauren Silverman is KERA's health science and technology reporter. Attorney Laura Riley O'Hara is a partner at Strasburger & Price, specializing in healthcare. And Nathan Cortez is associate dean for research and associate professor of law at SMU, where his research focuses on healthcare and biotech. It's been wonderful to have all of you here. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect is assistant producer with help on the phones today from Christina Ulsh. Our executive producer is Jeff Whittington. You can contact the show via email at think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.